Good afternoon. Dina Ponte and I go way back, so it's good to see you again as always. I'm delighted to be here with you and extremely, extremely proud. I want to thank Reverend Dr. Derek Hicks for the very kind invitation. I want to thank the Lancaster family for this overwhelming hospitality. I regret that I can't be with you tomorrow. I have to get to New York to honor a couple of other obligations, but I'll be with you in thought, and I'll be checking in with Dr. Hicks to see how things have gone. I won't talk with you this evening about humanism. I have another topic that I'd like to share with you. What I really want to do is till old soil. And by that, I mean I want to think out loud with you for a few moments. Well, I'll be honest, more than a few moments. About a question that has plagued me for some 16 years. It started when I was at McAllister College, and I went off to a seminary that will remain unnamed to give a talk. And I was excited about this material. This was heartfelt material. This meant something for me, right? I'm fresh out of graduate school, and I think I'm pushing the boundaries, and I think I'm saying something. And the first question I received after this was, well, Doc, how do I preach this? Doc, does this preach? And over the course of 16 years, I've heard this question over and over again. And one of the reasons it's intrigued me is because it's a layered question. It's far from simple, and for me, far from straightforward. Underneath this question, made up of just a few words, is a very long and troubled history. At its worst, it's meant to stifle conversation. It ends. I just want to, for a few minutes, kind of think about what this question alludes to. The assumption that there is some sort of gap between the academy and religious community. You pick the community. I don't think there is a gap. You may agree with me, but we probably think this for very different reasons. So I just want to spend a few minutes wrestling with this question. Doc, how do you preach this? Underlying assumption, there's a gap between what you say to me in the context of this academy and what needs to happen within the context of faith-based community. I get the irony of the location for this conversation. It's not lost on me. I imagine many, if not all of you, are familiar with the historian Gayroyd Wilmore, a tremendous scholar with a long and distinguished career connected to a variety of institutions, including New York Theological Seminary. If not by name, perhaps you've read some of his work on Black theology and religious history. Or, if not that, chances are you in some way have been influenced by his seminal text, Black Religion and Black Radicalism. Without question, it is a key text in the study of African-American religion, anchoring many courses and providing a way of framing the nature and meaning of African-American religious experience over time, and serving to map out and explain the workings of Black churches when they are at their theological and programmatic best and when they are at their worst. In short, since its publication, this text has provided a way to map out institutional development of African-American Christian experience, as well as the corresponding shifts in African-American Christian thought. Perhaps less commonly known and used, however, is his volume, African-American Religious Studies, an interdisciplinary anthology. The idea for this book, writes Wilmore, grew out of a course I taught at New York Theological Seminary. Students were introduced to the field by reading selected articles and were encouraged to think about what it would be appropriate form and content of a course on Black religion. And what follows is very important for us this evening. given the problems of ministry in the black church and the current state of African-American religious scholarship in the context of the struggle against racism and oppression. This allusion to the scholar's work vis-a-vis the church speaks to a long-standing debate concerning the proper allegiances of the academic, meant in certain respects to guard against the feared loss of Jesus through acquaintance with theological education, the assumption that learning can reduce one's spiritual burning. While Wilmore acknowledges the possibility of a more expansive and wide-ranging discussion, he sees this as more intimately linked to religious studies as undertaken outside of the seminary context and without significant applicability within the African-American context. It's what they do. Dominated as the African-American context is for Wilmore by black churches. He would probably agree with Joseph Washington, in the beginning was the black church. In a word, Wilmore assumes this broader approach lacks the clever combining of theory and practice so very needed within African-American quarters. For Wilmore, there's little reason to distinguish between African-American religious studies, as developed in the late 20th century, from a framework truncated and articulated in the language of practical theology. The best scholarship, he proclaims, is believing scholarship. In a sense, if Wilmore is correct, African-American religious studies is in the academy, but not necessarily of the academy. African-American religious studies, so conceived, he would have us understand, is more than, and I quote, another sequence of ego massaging, exercising, leading to a professional degree, end quote. Ouch. Again, the black church is the audience and concern of African-American religious studies. Hence, there is little justification, Wilmore notes, for theory without practice in the black church. According to Wilmore, the scholar of African-American religion, the one who studies African-American religion, should produce believing scholarship. That is to say, the scholar of religion works out of and responds to relationship with black Christian faith. This assumption, I believe, we must address. And in order to do that, I want to begin with a question, a version of which has sparked many conversations, discussions, yelling matches within the academy and within religious institutions. Simply put, should a scholar work from the center or the margins? Or put differently, is the scholar required to work on behalf of and from the context of a particular believing community? In this case, read black church. My question concerns a matter of location. The proper form of relationship to black churches, for example, necessary in order to engage these institutions as a scholar involved in the proper study of African-American religion. I ask this question as a way of exploring how scholars might understand the nature and purpose of their work, particularly in relationship to how scholars of religion think about their audience or audiences. Furthermore, discussing this question might just help members of religious communities better understand the nature and purpose of the scholar's work, and as a result, be prepared to better utilize the scholar's findings. It, in this way, is more than a simple question of how academic materials preach. Instead, it's a matter of understanding what academic scholars do and why they do it. As some of you are already aware, my friends in the audience, and I'm certain others will discern before our time together is over, I'm somewhat marginal to the inner workings of black churches. Yet, mine isn't a simple story of unfamiliarity with the black Christian tradition as housed in church structures. Far from the case. I grew up within the context of these structures, preached within the context of these structures, learning their language, symbols, signs, practices, and postures, and learning them well. There was something natural about church attendance and participation that I recognized and enjoyed even at an early age. Even when I was too young to appreciate or unpack sermons given by the pastor, I understood church in my own way as a period of community, a different type of space and time, a gathering during which normal time was suspended, daily obligations forgotten, and enjoyment was the rule. I'm not certain I understood a great deal about what took place on Sunday, but I did like the idea of spending time in the house of the Lord, who loved us and supposedly did wonderful things for us. The fine points of Black church theology escaped me during my youth, but I did get the essence of it. I was told God loved us, and we should love God, and as a result, we should try our very best to love each other. And all this was worked out each week during a few hours when we dressed in our best and fellowshipped. When I was young, my extended family often called me professor or preacher. I'm not quite certain why, but they did. You can imagine what this meant to a preteen. It provided a sense of purpose, a sense of place and space, a sense of obligation, something to shoot for in a world where each person must belong to something, as James Baldwin reminded us. It wasn't simply for this reason, however, that I would enter ministry. At the time, at 12, I felt something, a push, a sense of comfort with that path, and I followed it for as long and as faithfully as I could. Clear to me in various ways during my time in the church, particularly as a minister, was the sense that this community, or at very least communitas, came at a price. There was, of course, the fellowship of believers, an inside to church fellowship, and there was also a clear margin, the outlying areas of life populated by those others. Relying on memory, as problematic as that is, I would have to confess my early and graphic lessons on marginality stemmed from the theological rhetoric and religious practices of my home denomination in general and my local church, Agape AME Church, positioned at the edge of the Rust Belt in Buffalo, New York. Sunday morning services and Wednesday night prayer meetings often included a long and passionate litany of deeds and omissions that resulted in hell. The ultimate margin as negative and as punishment. Marginality implied a confining and fixing of perspectives and persons through perceived power and the framing of work outlining what is normal and what's acceptable. It was apparent to me this context, within this context, that it was a good idea to stay somewhat close to the theological center, or at the very least, perfect the ability to fake it. Jumping forward some years, it seems to me, in too many cases, this push for the normal, this center, a desire to stay within the center of Black church perspective and opinion, works its way into perceptions of the scholar's task. Recall the words of Gayward Wilmore, "The best scholarship is believing scholarship." While there's something to be said for familiarity with religious institutions and practices, I think we run a risk if the safeguarding of those practices and their underlying rationale gain too much consideration as we scholars of African American religion do our work. Much of what constitutes existing and critical engagement of the Black church resists direct confrontation with the underbelly of Black church practices. I don't need to name them. You know what they are. That's to say, scholars often sample the despair of life, but surface quickly to celebrate the nature of human history and the triumphs of the Black church. God is on the throne and all is well. Even when critiqued, the failings of Black churches regarding pressing issues are often assumed to be the consequence of misapplication and a misread of the Black Christian mission. We're just not getting it right. As practical theologian Dale Andrews phrases it, quote, "Black theology must press beyond its conclusive indictment of Black church practices and examine the conditions contributing to any hindrance or distortion of the church's mission. Shortcomings are often pitched as external to the tradition, a matter of taint, as opposed to being anything intimately connected to the tradition. A very popular form of this position involves an attack on the otherworldly orientation of black churches, which goes something like this. Black churches once championed the full range of needs represented in African American communities, from spiritual development to economic advancement. However, these churches have surrendered this concern for total liberation and have turned inward, giving priority to individual and spiritual salvation. This is what Gaylord Wilmore teaches us, the de-radicalization of black churches. There has emerged, however, another way to safeguard churches on the point of proper orientation. Regarding notions of de-radicalized black churches, Dale Andrews argues spirituality does not amount to otherworldliness. Perhaps Gaylord Wilmore has it wrong, and that it promotes liberation. He writes, quote, "Reliance upon the spiritual resources of the tradition does not necessarily indicate a defeated drive for equality. Contrary to many black theologians' assertions, black churches turn to these spiritual resources in the very pursuit of liberation. Hampered by the lack of political and economic power, black churches possess few resources beyond the spiritual and moral dimensions of their religious faith. This is all they had, so they worked with it." Suggesting a similar read, theologian Dwight Hopkins argues for proper orientation, quote, "Only a superficial understanding would prioritize a compensatory role as the primary purpose of the church. What has to be grasped is that the rituals of individual healing and celebration serve to recharge the worshiper's energy to deal with the rigors and racisms of a cruel, cruel world from Monday through Saturday. Thus, the church offers an armor of endurance, perseverance, self-esteem, and hope to allow people to get over with soulful dignity and psychic survival for another day's journey." While Hopkins offers an interpretation of black church practice that highlights the activism stemming from these seemingly passive practices, philosopher of religion Victor Anderson offers a bit more balance by suggesting the black church houses a particular range of values that are applied in both helpful, get this, and harmful ways. Anderson argues that the black church is a significant creative center of value, a location of stored meaning which produce both good and harm. He maintains that this center, as well as that of the family, offers great potential for the development of the beloved community. For Anderson, the beloved community is here meant to capture a more general notion of communal possibilities. Bringing this about, however, requires creative exchange between the churches and other centers of value. What Anderson offers is a depiction of black churches as thick and often paradoxical and contradictory. By so doing, he makes more difficult the somewhat flat presentations of the black church that hinder critique and overemphasize celebration. If black churches are getting it wrong, it's not their fault. However, he never loses sight of the black church's legacy. Quote, "Unlike any other mediating institution of civil society in the African American community, as a comprehensive institution, the black church is a center of value where the public and the private commitments of all its members meet. What's more, faithfulness to the best of the black church tradition means that all members seek faithfully to promote in the public realm the civil and human rights of all. All members seek to be faithful sustainers of norms and values that enrich the private realms of marriage, family, and sex, even if we have disagreement on what those norms and values should be." Must a scholar be a member of the black church in order to participate in this exchange? Anderson returned to the black church because, and I quote, "It was not enough for me to criticize the shortcomings of the church. I wanted to be a part of its moral and social renewal." This suggests one might need to answer this question, does the scholar have to be a part of this church, with at least a muffled yes. But does participation in this creative exchange really necessitate personal commitment to this institution, or at least a type of silence that allows the Black church and its advocates to assume like-mindedness? They won't ask, and we won't say. At work here is compliance with Black church orthodoxy that surfaces a form of hypocrisy, and that some studying Black churches with a perspective of transformation and inclusion soften their critique in order to maintain good relations with the Black church. Here's the point of great importance. So conceived, marginality forces consideration of whether we are on the creative edge of our fields or whether we are in fact reifying, fixing perspectives and opinions just to fit. Please understand, such a position can afford opportunity to view Black churches in ways that expose both their positive attributes and their harmful dimensions. Victor Anderson wants us to understand this, good and harm. The markers of Black churches work on behalf of better life options and align with the best of the gospel message should be celebrated. But there must be balance. To forget the achievements of figures such as Maria Stewart, Henry McNeil Turner, Julia Foote, Martin Luther King Jr., and a host of others would be sloppy. Yet, there are also flaws. Cornel West notes, "The profound insights and petty blindnesses, the immeasurable depths and immobilizing faults, incalculable richness and parochial impoverishment of that complex, high-bred people called Afro-Americans surface much clearly in the Black church. Failure to critique in the harshest terms possible the continuing discriminatory patterns found in too many Black religious contexts is irresponsible and amounts to a failure to fulfill the obligations of the profession. Some ministers and scholars insist that black religious studies in general and Black theology in particular must be in the service of the church. The making of this argument is often premised on the assumption of both, that the Black church's numerical dominance in Black communities, as well as Black church's function, according to ethicists like Peter Parris, as the custodians of the Black community's most basic societal values, give it a sort of dominance that has to be recognized and worked with. Parris's statement speaks to the intersection of both social ethics and Black churches. And the following statement by theologian James Evans addresses the relationship of theology to the churches in a way that also collapses the mission of one into the other. He writes, "It has unfortunately been the case that the work of Black theologians and the work of African-American churches have often been construed as separate types of activities. It would not be an exaggeration to say that the leadership of many Black congregations, large and small, and the ranks of professional Black theologians have looked on one another with caution and at times suspicion. This has resulted in a schism in the Black religious community between the theology and practice of Christian faith, leaving the churches with a religion that appears to be no more than a cultural performance, and the theologians with a theology that seems to consist of abstract concepts." Continuing along these lines, Evans asks a question. How can the dialogue between professional Black theologians and other members of the African American churches, be strengthened so that it becomes clear that Black theology is rooted in the faith of the church, and that the faith of the church is given intellectual clarity and expression in Black theology? And I'm not just picking on Black theology. I'm trained as a theologian, so I bring that to you because it's the area of Black religious studies that I know best, most intimately connected to. In a word, genuine theological judgment, writes Evans, requires a commitment to the community of faith. Theologians cannot tell other Christians, can't tell other Christians what they should believe, Rather, their task is to help the community understand more clearly what they believe and to assess those beliefs in light of the major sources of Christian revelation. While rhetorically this stance suggests a sense of communal encounter between thought and practice, it can serve to hamper the critical distance I believe is necessary to view the workings of black churches, for example, and assess their successes and their failures. That is to say, the assumption that only those personally committed to these churches can speak with authority concerning them is a dilemma, and that this required personal allegiance could short-circuit sustained critical engagement, and to the point, it can truncate what might be considered useful perspectives. I have an obligation to recognize the push for advancement as the normative structure within black theological discourses suggests some sense of an obligation extending beyond a simple explication of doctrine and conceptual arrangements. It's more than that. Hence, while filled with internal tensions, most black theologians, and I would argue womanist theologians as well, have softly framed theological inquiry along the lines of a constructive theology. Theological inquiry committed to reflecting on the pressing issues of our time. Yet this impulse towards a public place for theological reflection is tempered by an undercurrent of particularity. Theological reflection tied to the self-understanding of black churches. Theology is a second-order enterprise. It follows experience, narrates it, explains it. As constructive theologian Gordon Kaufman pointed out some years ago. However, I fear this has meant for many the theologian is simply a copy editor. That is, the theologian recounts the story of black faith with limited challenges and changes to the most significant content, certainly not in ways that call the fundamental meaning and nature of black churches into question. I'd want to suggest, however, the theologian should be an informed critic, not a compliant copy editor. Black theological discourse's relationship to the black church ebbs and flows, yet it's safe to argue, by and large, black theology has spent much of its existence, if not most of its existence, assuming black church ethos as correct and nurturing. Undergirding this posture is a desire on the part of some scholars of black religion to maintain, again, connection and avoid alienation from black churches, and that the self-understanding and vocation of many theologians is intimately tied to these churches and their perspectives. As theologian James Cone writes concerning the decline and negative critique over against celebration of the black church, we do not want to alienate black theology from its base in the black church and community. This type of stance shapes an economy of knowledge with respect to discussion of black churches, whereby critique can be read as disloyalty. The first thing that needs to be said, Cone writes, is that black theologians must never speak and write black theology as if they are not part of black churches and are not involved in the criticisms that are made against them. It's our solidarity with and participation in black churches that give us the right to speak prophetically. To think that we can do black theology apart from black churches is sheer theological nonsense. And if we do return to black churches with the intellectual humility and openness to be taught as well as to teach, then black churches should not listen to anything we say. Yet, why would Cone endorse this arrangement in light of the following comment concerning black churches? Seldom, he remarks, has the black church created the context for prophetic criticism to arise from within. That is, from among its own clergy and laity. This paradox, theologians committed to liberation, being bound to institutions hard-pressed to nurture and receive prophetic criticism, should raise a question. Can this required insider status allow the intellectual space necessary for sustained engagement that is unapologetic in nature? Dale Andrews poses a similar question. The major difficulty, he writes, facing Black theology is repositioning itself within Black churches without compromising its prophetic identity. How then can such an endeavor proceed? Yet Andrews and Cone assume the primacy of the Black church context as the only feasible location for scholarship and critique related to Black religion. My initial question should not be understood to imply a need for all theological discourse to be positioned externally to Black churches. Did you hear that? I'll say it one more time so you don't go home getting it twisted. My initial question should not be understood to imply a need for all theological discourse to be positioned externally to Black churches or other faith communities, right? Because there is more than the Black church. Instead, I'm suggesting recognition that scholarly discourse must not have as its final litmus test church authority vis-a-vis church agreement with the scholar's work. The work can be good and right, and the church disagree with it. Contrary to my position, Evans and numerous others argue for the authenticity of theological reflection as measured relationships and allegiance to Black churches. But I wonder if such a stance does not, in fact, foster the assumed gap between the academy and the Black church. Here it is. Some argue this gap emerges out of a vaguely defined anti-intellectualism within churches, a privileging of spiritual prowess over book learning, and a generally dismissive attitude within the academy that fails to fully comprehend and consider the workings of Black churches. The church slogan attached to the position has been told to many would-be scholars: don't go to school and lose Jesus. In opposition to this genealogy, I argue the idea of a gap between the academy and the Black church is premised on faulty reasoning and wrong-headed assumptions concerning a necessary link between the study of Black churches and the function of Black churches. In actuality, there isn't a gap. The current misunderstanding between the academy and the church, I think, is better described as tension. For centuries, churches have relied heavily on theology for voicing concern both inside and outside church walls, motivating congregations, unpacking religious language, and demystifying rituals. Hence, it makes sense that churches would first turn to their attention to theologians in the academy and raise questions concerning their allegiance to the community of faith, arguing that theologians, as a symbol of the academy, should speak with the same voice and conviction as church leaders and laity. This point of view fails, however, to recognize the function of academic inquiry. Such a disconnect need not be perceived as a negative occurrence or something needing to be repaired. Leave the tension alone. Rather, this gap is the natural and creative distance between two strong realities, two approaches to understanding and addressing human needs, two approaches that are often in conflict, and that's okay. We shouldn't begin our thinking by assuming the scholar shares a particular faith orientation, but instead we should push scholarship to explore the benefits and shortcomings of religious perspectives and opinions through a type of measured realism. And this measured realism, seeing things as they are and being comfortable with the paradox, involves an understanding of religion, in this case, Black churches, as marked by the doing, again, of great good and great harm. While the scholar might, in fact, affiliate with the Black church tradition, this posture towards discourse necessitates recognition that Black churches do not have privileged information, nor should they hold a privileged position. To assume otherwise, again, is wrong-headed, and that it fails to recognize the religious pluralism, one that marks African-American communities, and as a result, responds to churches as if they exist in isolation. Emerging from this type of reflection is a truncated and warped understanding of black churches in terms of their development, function, capabilities, and needs. I'm suggesting understanding of critical engagement as a means by which to explore the religiosity, the nature and meaning of African Americans in wide-ranging ways. It's not tied to any particular religious community, but rather it is concerned with a range of questions brought to bear on a variety of orientations and without privileging any particular orientation. Mindful of this, I want to suggest a good marker of the academic's work as productive is not to achieve or seek the agreement of the faithful. Rather, it is more useful to mark the quality of the academic's work on black churches as productive based upon factors such as the following. One, deep engagement done in recognition of a religious community's claims and positions. Know what the folks believe. Two, thoughtful critique and celebration that holds churches accountable for their thought and activity based on their expressed mission and vision. Critique and celebration based upon the correspondence between what faith communities say they do and what they actually do. Three, familiarity with the existing literature and the changing dynamics of religious communities. Do your homework. Four, maintenance of multi-layered liberation as the proper normative stance. And five, recognition of the competing faith claims making up the religious landscape of black community as the context for the study of black churches or any other religious community. Yes, millions of black Christians, if you take seriously the roles offered by these denominations and conventions. Now, of course, those roles may contain some folks who haven't been there in a while because they're in Forest Lawn Cemetery, but that's beside the point. The numbers are significant, yes. But 30,000 Buddhists in African-American communities. 3 million Sunni Muslims in African-American communities. Forget the number of those who practice African traditional religions. All of this makes up a thick, complex, religious environment home to competing faith stances, and the scholar of African-American religion ought to be sensitive to this. The kind of discourse I call for requires celebration, but also sustained critique and recognition of the demonic within religious communities and orientations. In part, this rethinking of the scholar's task requires greater sensitivity to the merit of external critique, challenges, and questions from those who do not hold the same faith commitment and theological sensibilities. That is to say, it makes the work a little harder. This approach, I believe, does not take away from the work of the scholar of African-American religion, nor does it damage the importance of the black churches and other faith communities that mark the religious geography of African-American communities. Instead, it provides context, and I hope it allows for an exchange with black churches, but only as one of competing, of many competing audiences, one of many conversation partners. What's more, it opens discussion of black churches to a variety of figures, some with personal relationships to these churches and others, like me, without those relationships. Such an arrangement frees us to think the hard and difficult thoughts and questions and provide the most complex and thoughtful depictions of what it means to be black and religious we can possibly offer. The relationship between the scholar and faith communities is only one of the issues. I'd also suggest scholars wrestle with a sense of proper engagement with the communities beyond the walls of their institutions. The tensions between the academy and the church, for example, are also rivaled by tensions between the town and the gown. This has certainly been an issue at my home institution, Rice University, and that the hedges, those beautiful hedges surrounding the campus, have often served as a porous but permanent boundary between the world of Rice University and the larger Houston community. Dr. Hicks asked me to talk a bit in conclusion about some of the work we've tried to do to work with that tension, right, to make certain that that tension is productive and creative. So I want to share a couple of thoughts concerning this program that we have called Houston Enriches Rice Education. But first, for those of you who aren't familiar with Houston, let me give you a sense of what Houston entails. Houston is part of the Texplex, which is the triangular region of Texas: Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio, and Austin, serving as home to roughly 80% of the state's population. Within those cities, roughly 80% of the state's population — I'm talking people, not cattle — 80% of the state's population, and a significant percentage of its economic power. And it was listed in a Forbes magazine article as one of the best cities in the nation with respect to job creation. There are jobs in Houston. Houston's port is the second busiest port in the country. It's the fourth largest city, soon to be third. And according to The Economist, it is the city of the 21st century based on levels of diversity, economic potential, and other factors. It is true that Houston represents a population marked by a large percentage of African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. In fact, as of 2004, whites no longer represented the majority population in Texas. And Houston serves as a prime example of this racial diversity, fairly evenly split between white Americans, African Americans, Latinos, Latinas, fairly evenly split. But Houston also has the third highest poverty rate in the nation, the second highest imprison rate, the highest teenage birth rate, and the lowest portion of high school graduates in Texas are in Houston. According to the Kauffman Foundation, Texas is facing a significant decline in economic power and overall quality of life. And Houston is home to a good number of Texans whose life options are damaged by high rates of socioeconomic suffering. Lots of jobs, but not for everybody. The present does not point to such a bright future for most of Houston's residents. And a significant percentage of Houston's citizens, most at risk, are, as you might imagine, African Americans and Latinos. According to one report, the health risks associated with petrochemical plants have a tremendous impact in that the neighborhoods most affected, mainly in the southeast part of Houston, in proximity to the Houston Ship Channel, are almost completely Latino. According to a University of Texas School of Public Health study, in 2007, children residing as far as 2 miles from the Ship Channel have more than a 55% greater chance of contracting the devastating acute leukemia that children further from this area. The location of these health-damaging industries has been labeled by experts environmental racism. In addition, low test scores and alarmingly high dropout rates mark the Houston Independent School District, responsible for educating most of the African Americans and Latinos in Houston. In terms of dropout rates, a recent Johns Hopkins University study noted that 22 Houston Independent School District schools had a dropout rate of over 40%. The connections to this for African Americans, Hispanics, is even more troubling, in that 70% of those dropping out are African American and Hispanic. And we lose a significant percentage of those in that transition from 10th grade to 11th grade. 70% of the high school students in the Houston Independent School District qualify for free lunch. That means they represent families of three with an income of roughly $23,000 or less, 70% of the students. So clearly, there's a lot to celebrate in Houston, but there's also tremendous misery. And cushioned within the context of this city in turmoil is this lovely campus, Rice University, the most significant institution of higher learning in the state, residing behind the hedges. Now, I don't want to suggest, because it wouldn't be fair, that Rice has no interactions with the larger Houston community. There's the passport to Houston, so students are given free transportation into the city. Lots of classrooms make use of Houston as a laboratory for the students. There is some engagement. I wouldn't be fair if I said that Houston and Rice had no relationship. They do, and in certain ways, that relationship is rather productive. However, from my perspective, there was an opportunity for advancement with respect to how this contact impacted the learning experience and the production of knowledge on campus, and how it impacted in positive ways life options in Houston. I wanted to foster synergy between the city's richness along these lines and the university's experience, opportunities, and resources. I also felt that as an African-American faculty member, the highest ranking African-American faculty member on the campus, the first African-American to hold an endowed chair at Rice, I had a particular responsibility to do something, not simply because I was at Rice, because my mother raised me right. I had an obligation to try to do something. But get this, it was to do something based upon the humble skills and talents I've been blessed to possess. Right? One of the things I would get from my undergraduates when I taught at McAllister College was, well, what do you do for the people, Dr. Penn? And I'd say, well, I do this, this, and this. No, really, what? That's just, you know, that's book stuff. What do you really do for the people? Now, it wasn't a question that doctors would get. Or attorneys would get, but there's nothing about this production, if not nothing that you're involved in that really helps the people. How do you really help the people? And I've been convinced from day one, from the first day I stepped on campus at McAllister College to the time I transitioned to Houston, that there was something about what we do as academics that could have real impact on quality of life beyond the borders of our campuses. So I went to the president with an idea, and I said, look, we could do better than this. We ought to be doing better than this. That our reputation in the larger Houston community isn't extremely positive. We can do better than this. But it's got to involve more than our students understanding Houston as their laboratory. They go get stuff, right? It's kind of exotic. Maybe they'll wander into the Fifth Ward, you know, and then they'll go back to the safety of the campus. And if folks from off campus can figure out how to maneuver around the campus, can figure out how to get on campus, are willing to pay the $9 to park on campus, can find the proper building, although they're not really clearly marked, then they're welcome too. But it just seemed to me we could do better than this. And so I proposed a project, the Houston Enriches Rice Education Project, that was meant to provide a synergy between Houston and Rice based upon where both were located, that there were certain things that Rice could provide. And as a faculty member at Rice, there were certain things that I could provide. And we wanted to do this in four ways. First, a distinguished lecturers program. I wanted our undergraduates to rethink how knowledge is produced and who has it. Right, to move them away from the notion that if this person doesn't have a PhD and a PhD from a certain type of place, nothing you can tell me. Right, to think about life experience, community standing, as having real merit. And so through this program, we bring people of high standing within the community to campus to teach a course through the regular curriculum. They are housed in a department, and we pay them triple the going rate for adjuncts on campus. The obligation is to develop a course that ties academic inquiry to life in Houston. So Reverend Dr. William Lawson taught our first course on religion and social transformation in Houston. Dr. Hicks was his teaching assistant. So we have these sorts of courses taking place. Next year, I'm really happy about this, and if you know rap music, this will mean something to you. We're having a course taught next year. I teach this course, Religion and Hip-Hop Culture, but next year I won't be teaching it alone. Bun B will co-teach the course next spring. Right? So for some of you, I can see the faces. For some of you, that means, for others, it's like, well, whatever. Okay. Mr. Bun B, okay. But we want these students to rethink what it means to hold and share knowledge, to rethink notions of pedagogy. We're also committed to the idea that Rice has an obligation that extends beyond the students who pay tuition. In part, this obligation involves Rice helping Houston to preserve its historical and cultural memory. In a city without zoning, the African-American historical presence in certain areas wiped out. You go to Midtown, and you're hard-pressed to think that there was anything of merit about the black presence within that area. Historical and cultural memory wiped out. I think we have an obligation to help preserve that. So we have an archival collection. Reverend Dr. William Lawson's, his papers are in it. His wife's papers are in it. The Blue Triangle Multicultural Center is a major location for civil rights activities. Their materials are in it. Next week, I have a meeting, again, for folks who like hip-hop, this will mean something to you. Next week, I have a meeting with Yolanda Prince and Mr. Jay Prince to discuss the moving of Rap-A-Lot Records materials into the archival collection. Right, so we also want to give a very different sense of where merit is located. Right, so it's not simply Reverend Lawson with the wingtips and the nice suit. It's Mr. J. Prince with the jeans, the Air Force Ones, and the diamond robe, right? That there's a tremendous amount of cultural material here that we ought to help preserve. We also want to bring folks to campus who have standing to help us think through the issues that matter to Houston and as a result ought to matter to Rice. So we'll bring in speakers to talk about a variety of issues. In the fall, we'll have one of these talks revolve around sex trafficking in Houston, because it's a problem. We've also talked about the transition, the gentrification of areas, and what that has meant for Latinos and African Americans. Finally, it seems to me that we have an obligation to impact the lives, again, of students who don't pay tuition. And we've got to start with high school students who are most at risk. By 10th grade, the end of 10th grade, we're losing so many of them. And within a short distance from Rice University, there are 11 deeply troubled high schools. And these students don't really know that Rice exists. Now, how can that be okay? They don't know we exist. Our presence doesn't impact quality of life in any perceivable way. When I was a graduate student in Cambridge, the presence of these institutions, whether people were in them or not, impacted how people perceived themselves and the issues that matter, simply because those schools were there. And so what I decided to do is we've got to help students in these high schools critically engage their world and understand the merit, the importance of critically engaging the issues that impact their lives. So we've started small. We have an essay contest that's only open to 10th and 11th graders in these 11 select schools. And each year, the essay revolves around, again, something that impacts life in Houston. This year, the question was, you've been asked to run for mayor. You've agreed, and now you have to give your platform speech. What is the issue you're going to address first for Houston, and why? First time we held this contest, 30 applications. This year, 145. Encouraging these students to think critically about the world. First place, $1,000. Second place, $750. Third place, $500. Seven honorable mentions. All 10 come to campus over the course of the summer and take the Princeton Review course. After beating my head on the door in conversations with the VP for enrollment, it is quite clear that standardized tests will always matter. I'm not going to be able to change that. But we can help students think about these tests. Right? And even these students in 10th and 11th grade who say, I want to be a mathematician, I want to be a doctor, right? Providing them an opportunity to figure out what that means in 11th grade and 12th grade so that they don't show up at Texas Southern or don't show up at Rice not having taken the basic courses necessary in order to be competitive. Right? So we start with the essay contest, and ultimately our goal is to hold a two-year program called Here Scholars. And these students would get basic information on applying to college, many courses in a variety of subjects. NASA has agreed to provide some of their staff to teach some of these courses. But we'd also have these students, again, not only prepare themselves, but also understand that their preparation, their success, has to be tied to the welfare of their larger community. So they're responsible for doing a community-based project in connection with this academic advancement. For me, this is a small way in which we get to make a difference, right? That, again, it's not simply the conversation between academics and churches and other religious institutions that press us to think about how we understand what we do, why we do it, and who's impacted by it. It's the larger connection between us, our institutions, and the communities in which these institutions exist, and what we ought to do to make a difference in those. Ultimately, I want to think that I'm doing this because of what my grandmother told me long, long ago. She said, walk through the world knowing your footsteps matter. Thank you.